So welcome to your second class on Le passé dans le présent. And I think we've gone through quite a number of things. The ways in which people see the past today, whether it's in school because they're obliged to see them, whether it's in the statues or plaques, which you might see some days. In fact, you often see them more when you're on holiday because you're walking more slowly. So, oh, really? I didn't know that. Yeah. Or whether it's on some sort of official recognition occupying public space. Stamps, banknotes, etc. Most of these things come from the initiative of government. Government decides what to put in the school books. Local government usually decides what to put in a statue. But you can have popular initiatives, a campaign for a statue for this particular person. Yeah, so there are different actors who can get involved. And the last aspect of Le passé dans le présent, which I wanted to look at, is this idea of apologies and protests. And just to show that I prepare my lessons anew every year. Here is an article from the newspaper from yesterday, October 2019. Thank you. United Kingdom expresses regrets over Maori killings after Cook's arrival in New Zealand. Don't get me started on Captain Cook. I can do 6 hours on Captain Cook. It's the new question for the aggregation, so I do all about it. So, interesting thing, just to remind you, because you probably don't know, 1769. Cook is the first person to, not exactly the first person, but almost the first, the first European to arrive in New Zealand. And he arrives and, you know, there are some skirmishes. The first contact is carried out with a tremendous amount of misunderstanding on both sides. From Cook's point of view, he has instructions which say, you must respect the people who live there. But he also has instructions which say, you must take possession in the name of Her Majesty of any land you find. Which is less than completely respectful, one might think. In any case, in the earliest things, people were killed because when the Maoris arrived to see what was going on, well, one side had guns and the other side did not have guns. Now, the British did not have guns because they were superior at technology. The Chinese invented it. But the British were lucky enough to be part of a very huge continent with learning from everywhere. The compass from China, writing from the north of Africa, gunpowder again from China. In any case, when there was a fight, the Maoris always lost. And so today we have the United Kingdom expressing regrets over Maori killings in 1769. So there's something new about this. 50 years ago, this was probably not going to happen because there wasn't the same government attitudes, neither to the Maori experience nor to things that happened a long time ago. This is a new tendency for governments to apologise. Now, most often governments do not apologise, but if they do apologise, it's in the last 50 years this has begun. I don't think that before 1970 any government ever really apologised. Yeah, that was not a thing. So, of course, this involves in Britain a certain debate with some people saying, well, you're apologising for something in 1769, what does this mean? How could this be useful? And other people saying, well, at last we've got some sort of recognition which compensates a little for 200 years of hero worship of Captain Cook. You know, see, the apology is never without a context. There's a huge context, and the context is that, you know, Captain Cook statues are everywhere. Captain Cook, there's even a children's song, and so on. So in a general context of no sympathy or interest in the Maori experience, that's where the gains its solidity. This kind of thing is more likely in New Zealand than in Australia. You don't know why, but I know why. 13% of people of New Zealand identify as Maori, and only 3% of people in Australia identify as Aboriginal. So from a political point of view, it's a much easier to have a Maori voice saying things in New Zealand than in Australia. And the past in the present, extremely present in New Zealand today. Because Captain Cook, when he arrived, he said, "Oh, look at that mountain. I named that mountain after my friend, the Duke Egmont." Now, if I came to your house and I said, "Oh, look, there's a cat. I'll name it Alex." Well, you say, "What'd you get lost? That's my cat, yeah?" But yet, that's not how Cook thought. So going around naming things, and these names are still used. Yeah, so the past and the present is very present. Mount Egmont is a mountain in New Zealand named after the Duke of Egmont by Captain Cook. Yeah, so as they say, you know, the past is never forgotten. It's not even past. Yeah, the past is never past. And New Zealand has a very specific policy today, very different from other countries. They have a policy of biculturalism. So, for example, this mountain that Captain Cook named now, today, I think it's about 10 years ago, I'm not sure, a few years ago, this mountain has two names now. Two official names. They have kept Captain Cook's name, Mount Egmont, and they have also restored the Maori traditional name. So they have both names. And this is a political decision. And absolutely the past and the present. Yeah, absolutely the past and the present in a very real way. Some other countries do this as well. I don't know. Do you? You probably don't know Australia very well. I don't know Australia very well. Do you remember that huge red rock in the middle of Australia? Famous huge red rock. Does anybody know the name of it? Okay, it has two names. It was called Ayers Rock for 150 years. Captain Ayer was the British person who discovered it. But everybody, the people who lived there knew it was there. Yeah, so it's the name taken, and it was also called, traditionally it was called Uhuru by the Aboriginals. And today the colonial name has been eliminated, and it is known as Uhuru. And the local council of Aboriginal peoples has some control about whether you may climb up it or not. Yeah, so these are questions of tradition. So this is a brand new one. UK expresses regrets. The statement made ahead of the 250th anniversary of Cook's arrival, which is in a few weeks' time, stops short of apology. So they say we regret it. But it's not. But they don't say we apologise for it. It's very close things. Yeah. Don't try it with your girlfriend. I regret it, but I'm not apologising. No. Dangerous. Okay. So that's only a joke. Seriously, there's some very careful politics going on. It's not an official apology. I have put this article on my blog, and I'm going to put on the blog a little collection of articles of this kind, so that you can quote a few examples. Here is just last month, similar idea in connection with the commemoration of the Captain Cook circumnavigation of New Zealand. First of all, they were very, very careful. They wanted to celebrate the 250 years since Captain Cook went all the way around New Zealand and discovered it was three islands and not one. There's one little one at the bottom, two big ones, one little one. But they wanted to celebrate, but 13% of the population identify as Maori, and a lot of others consider that the Maoris have a point. And so they didn't. They have a replica of Captain Cook's ship, and they decided not to do Captain Cook's ship goes all around, but Captain Cook's ships and several other ships, including several Maori, traditional Maori ships. So yeah, so this is the idea, this is a sort of compromise. Let's see if we can commemorate it all together. Now, this may not be possible, I don't know. But the attempt, the intention, is to have a shared history. Okay, but not everybody was in agreement. So one local Maori tribe said, "No, we don't want Captain Cook, he's a barbarian, don't want him." Again, this is in the context of being told for 250 years, or being told for 240 years, that he was a total hero. Right. There are more apologies than more apologies. Some of them are more surprising than others. Some of them less surprising than others. Here you have church offers apology for its role in slavery. This is from The Telegraph, which I'm sure you remember is a conservative daily newspaper. From London, a conservative daily newspaper, the most conservative of the serious daily newspapers. that, and in this this kind of newspaper, church means the Church of England, yeah, because that's the only one which is important to the Daily Telegraph, yeah, which is fair enough. Church offers apology for its role in slavery. This is 2006, so this is a few years ago. 200 years after Anglican reformers helped to abolish the slave trade, the Church of England has apologised for profiting from it. It has to be said that this was not just the Church of England investing money and receiving it. The Church of England owned sugar plantations in the Caribbean, which were worked by slaves. The church was the owner of some of the farms here, so it was a really very high level of implication. And so here you get an official Church of England apology, which has been generally considered in Britain to be a good thing. Although, of course, there are people who think it's not a good thing. So you should forget history, which is now. Quite often they say, you should forget history. You're being political if you want to remember it. And of course, remembering history is political, but forgetting history is also political. You can't avoid being politics, because being political, politics won't avoid you. More on the slavery thing. Glasgow University. Again, they issued a public apology. This is quite recent, last year, I think. I think it's 2018. So Glasgow University, because these are very old institutions, they made a lot of money from slavery, a lot of money. Slavery was very, very profitable. And so they officially apologised. Even though, as I was mentioning last week, the situation is not quite as hot as in the United States, because Glasgow University does not have a lot of students. Glasgow University was not actually built by slaves, physically built by slaves, so it's a little less hot emotionally. Nevertheless, those are things. I said this last year, so I won't say it again. The slave trade was abolished in the British Empire and slavery was abolished and compensation paid in. And the answer is 1807 for the abolition of the slave trade, and 1833 for the abolition of slavery in the British Empire. Now, the question of apologies is very often linked to questions of reparation. Again, this is a debate whether it is possible to make reparation for this kind of thing. And in any case, Glasgow University decided that they were going to, because they had received a long time ago a huge amount of money from the slaves. Today they have decided to do two things: to establish a centre for research on slavery, so they're doing as a partial kind of reparation, and a memorial in the name of the slaves. So a memorial in Glasgow University saying publicly, Glasgow University apologises, they received a lot of money. So this is about occupying public space and occupying public memory, and making some people happy and some people angry, like most things you do in public life. Australia is perhaps one of the best examples of one of the most famous examples of apologies. Have you heard of this apology? This is about 20 years ago. No. Okay, this is a big one. In Australia, every year they have one day. La fête des excuses. C'est pas une blague. Sorry Day. Every year there is a day called Sorry Day, this is much more important than just having a statue saying you're sorry. Every year you have a day to look at being sorry. And what are they sorry about? Well, one of the reasons that in Australia the apology has been bigger, because like I say, every year a day is much more important, one of the most important ones, is because the experience of Aboriginals in Australia was particularly harsh. Now, all countries have plenty of racism, but Australia for 50 years had an official policy. The official government policy was entitled, the title of the policy was White Australia. Okay, so la avantage de la clarté. Yeah, and for the longest time, Aboriginals could not vote. But probably the worst element is that it was considered, the official position was that Aboriginals was an inferior culture and should disappear, and therefore that the best thing to do for Aboriginal children was to take them away from their families and to give them to white families. And so they did this for 50 years, not all of them, but the. And so literally, if you were an Aboriginal, your children were playing in the streets, sometimes the police would come and kidnap your children and you would never see them again. And they would be given, they would often be told their parents were dead, and they would be given to white parents. So, as you can imagine, you know, this is kind of, you know, this is kind of extremely heavy. And in 1998 then, that the this was closed down, the policy was closed down, I think in the 1980s, and an official apology was given. But as you can, and there's still things going on. Even today, you still see stories of, after 40 years, I have found my mother. Yeah, I was a kidnapped child. This is what they call the stolen generation. There are some amazing autobiographies of children who were stolen, but you need to have the Kleenex ready. They're extremely extremely sad and horrible. Yeah, the first Sorry Day was held in 1998. Okay, 1998 was the first Sorry Day, so it's been 20 years, and it is fairly well known, but obviously not that well known if you didn't know about it. So extremely, and again, this is, so there is a big variety, because obviously apologising for people being killed 250 years ago is not exactly the same as apologising to people who are still alive and have never saw their mother again because they were kidnapped and she died somewhere. You know, there are different levels, different times. Before the official apology in 1992, the Prime Minister for the first time recognised we took the children from their mothers, because for a long time they said, "No, it's not true. It's an exaggeration." Yeah, and that's the Sorry Day in Australia. Here's another apology. Who is this gentleman? I use the word in the widest sense. It's David Cameron. It's David Cameron. So it's got to be recent, yeah? He was Prime Minister until last year. What is he apologising for? This is an official apology. The reason there is a big screen is because everybody wants to see him live apologising. Anybody know what he's apologising for? Yes? That's a 30-year civil war. So it's part of the Troubles, yes, but a specific event during the Troubles. Yeah, absolutely. Bloody Sunday. Did I mention Bloody Sunday last week? No. Okay, so Bloody Sunday, just to remind you, I think it's 12 or 14 young unarmed demonstrators were shot dead in 1972. And the government and the army said it's self-defense. It was self-defense. And it took took 20 years to have a second public inquiry, and it became obvious that, the young people were shot in the back, and none of them were carrying guns. This was in many ways the beginning of the Troubles. Do stop me if I said this last week, because I get mixed up with my different times. This was in many ways the beginning of the Troubles, because hundreds of people saw it happen. It was in the council estates. And hundreds of people were watching out the window and saw the children being shot. Well, the children, the young men being shot. And so this transformed the situation. Before Bloody Sunday, there was a debate among the Republicans. Some of them said, we need a military organisation. We need the IRA. We can win United Ireland with military things. And another group said, no. We need a political solution, demonstrations, petitions, elections. That is the solution. That was before Bloody Sunday. After Bloody Sunday, the debate was completely different. Somebody said, I think we need a political solution. And the other side said, you watched your children shot dead in front of their house. How stupid are you? The easiest job in the world in 1972 was recruitment office of the IRA. People knocked on the door and said, can I join? extremely easy. And of course, this was the beginning of the military conflict, which lasted for almost 30 years. It wasn't quite the beginning, but it was the accelerator. And one of the conditions for the end of it, the Good Friday Agreement, in 1998 was only possible if the government agreed to have a second inquiry on Bloody Sunday, about Bloody Sunday. Because if not, the Republican negotiators about Good Friday said, you know, if you want us to tell our people that their children were shot and there's nothing that can be done, they will prefer to have a war. Yeah, because there's a red line. There was a red line there. So here he is then apologising officially. Apology for Bloody Sunday, 2010. I'm not very good at dates. 2010, the apology for Bloody Sunday then. And Bloody Sunday happened in 1972. Yeah, so sometimes you have to be patient, although the Maori waited 250 years, so that's even more impressive. More apologies and protests. Here we have a recent campaign, a very well-known campaign, I mean, in Britain, in the University of Oxford. Here is the University of Oxford, and here is one of the institutions, one of the colleges. And there's a statue of Cecil Rhodes. Cecil Rhodes, I'm sure you... Do you remember the name of the country Zimbabwe before it was called Zimbabwe? Rhodesia. It was named after this guy, Cecil Rhodes, a big colonial hero for the colonialists. He was not completely convinced of the equality of different kinds of people. Let's say, yeah, okay. He was, unsurprisingly, he wrote a whole series of extremely racist documents. And therefore, there has been a campaign, Rhodes Must Fall. We don't want his statue in front of our university building. That's the campaign. It's called Rhodes Must Fall. Decolonize education, Rhodes Must Fall. And again, here, what is important from the point of view of the CAPES is not so much your precise opinion on this, but that you can show what are the arguments being used. And the arguments being used are, on the one side, people say, oh, well, no, it's history. If you take away the statue, we're forgetting our history. And on the other side, and I'm not trying to hide my sympathy here, more the argument, it's not just history. When you have a statue at the gate, it is glorification of history. So it's completely different to have a statue of Cecil Rhodes at the gate of the university, or to have a statue of Cecil Rhodes in a museum with explanations. That's completely different. Yeah, they're two completely different things. So I'm not trying to pretend I don't have an opinion. Yeah, you don't have to have the same opinion as me. Nobody cares. Nobody else does. So Rhodes Must Fall. It was not successful. The statue is still there. But I think there is a plaque with some explanation. This is sometimes a compromise which is made. We saw this in other countries as well, although I'm only going to talk about Britain because that's what I'm paid for. But you remember, no, you don't remember, you're too young, but you have seen that in Eastern Europe, when the state capitalist regimes fell and the Soviet Union fell to pieces and the East Germany fell to pieces, what did they do? They destroyed the statues of Stalin and the statues of Lenin. So it's always had an import. It's always had a political importance. Whose statues you have where? So here you have the explanation. But I've already talked about that. So I'm not going to do any more about that right now. While we're on colonialism, we're talking about decolonizing. This is an argument. I think it has to be said that in Anglophone countries, the idea that history and education and public space needs to be decolonized is a more popular idea than it is in France. In France, this is a small, you hear it from time to time, but it's not a powerful thing. Whereas in Britain, for example, well, in America especially, the idea of decolonizing is a very strong idea. Still, probably still a minority, but a big minority, a very loud minority. Seeing as we are at colonialism, I thought, revise a few dates. It's always good to revise a few dates to have some sort of idea. Independence of America, independence of India, which today is divided into three countries, India, Pakistan and Bangladesh, but at the time it was just India. First country in Africa to gain independence from Britain, attention, question piège. Number of African countries which were previously British colonies. Last country of Africa to gain independence from Britain. And most recent country in the world to gain independence from Britain. Now, some of these are kind of, some of these are kind of trick questions, yeah? Because I don't expect you to know them all, but there they are. Independence of America, 1776, that was not too hard, I hope. Independence of India, 1947. The first country in Africa to gain independence from Britain. This is a slightly bizarre because everybody says Ghana. Ghana is famous for being the first country in Africa. But technically, Sudan was first. It's a little bit complicated because sometimes you get the writing of the constitution and then the signing of the constitution 2 years later. So sometimes dates are not exactly precise, but those were the first ones. The number of African countries which were previously British colonies, 19. Okay, you don't have to name them all. I can't name them all. But, 19 African countries, it's a certain number. Last country of Africa to gain independence from Britain, technically Zimbabwe, in 1980. Again, technically, I won't go into the political details. It was a little bit complicated. In fact, what happened is that the British elite had decided more or less to accept the wave of independence. There wasn't much they could do about it, so okay, independence. And Rhodesia, which was governed by a white government which refused to allow the vote to blacks, could not find an agreement with Britain, because Britain by this point was obliged to say, no, we will only support independence for a democratic government where white and black people can vote. And so Rhodesia declared independence unilaterally. The white government of Rhodesia said, okay, we're independent. But this was not recognised by Britain because of the racist question. And finally, when the black nationalists overthrew the white minority, they negotiated independence with from Britain. And the most recent, Hong Kong, 1997, very much in the news today, of course. Very much in the news today. Although really, the British ought to keep quiet, because the British controlled Hong Kong from 1797 until 1997, and the first elections were in the 1980s. So, other countries in the world can criticise China for not being democratic in Hong Kong, but really Britain should keep its mouth shut, because it was not so interested in democracy. That's the Roads Must Fall thing. I don't know why that's there. It's out of order. This carries on into other countries as well. In Belgium, there was an official apology this year, 2019. Yeah, so this is a present, and it's not just the past in the 1960s, which is the present to me, but the past to you. Belgium apologising for kidnapping children from African colonies. And the apology is in 2019. Yeah, you are allowed to give one or two examples from other countries. Yeah, of course, 90% of your writing must be about Britain or America or whatever the subject is. But you can throw in one that sounds fine. So that was apologies and protests. I will send you some more articles. I think it's important to try to be precise and to try to realize that there are these different categories of apologies. And also that it is relatively recent. Now, be careful, of course, when a historian says recent, that means in the last 50 years. Yeah? Not so long ago means in the last 100 years. That's how we do things. So my last, the past in the present, is about popular culture and history. Because as you know, and it's a huge tragedy, well, maybe not, but it appears to be a huge tragedy, most people do not read history books. Even worse, most people do not read my history books, which is absolutely terrible, but what can you do? But this is not because people don't like history. Museums are tremendously popular. I went last week to the Tutankhamun exhibition. 1.5 million people went to it in France. Yeah, okay, so you can't say that history is not interesting people. People like historical novels. Has anybody ever read a book by Ken Follett? Ken Follett writes historical novels, which sell millions. Il y avait Les Piliers de la Terre, ensuite il y avait La Chute des Géants. Extremely popular, they sold millions. But just to give you an idea, I don't mean everybody's read them, but you can buy them in railway stations. Yeah, you don't have to go to a history bookshop, you can buy them in railway stations. So historical novels and films occasionally present history. Interestingly enough, television series are sometimes very popular because they present imaginary history. Like Game of Thrones is very historical. I don't mean it's true, but it's very historical in its form. It's about, you know, dynasties and traditions. Another thing which is very popular in Britain and has not taken up so much in France is television series based on history, very popular. Now, there is a long tradition of them. I mean, sometimes it's kind of a very little part of history. For example, you know, the sort of Jane Austen television series. Well, it is an accurate portrayal of 18th century life, but it's a very little 18th century life, rich people in the countryside, you know, very, very little. It's not about big ones. But there's been a tremendous explosion in Britain of historical television, and in particular, historical reality TV. So let's have a look at it. This is not historical reality TV, this is just historical television. Extremely popular, millions of viewers every week. It's called Call the Midwife. Appelez la sage-femme. And it's based on what life was like for a midwife in the poor parts of London in the 1950s. Very poor, very rough, yeah. Tremendously popular. So these are fictional series. These are fictional series, but based on serious historical research. And also, notice, not based on kings and prime ministers, but the life of ordinary people, and in particular, poor people. Of course, if you're looking at fictional history, not everybody loves Downton Abbey, but a lot of people love Downton Abbey. And they do work very hard at the history. Now, it is not neutral. It is fundamentally a defence of aristocracy, but a very, very well done, very, very well done defence of aristocracy. It's very, very interesting because 50 years ago there was a television series called Upstairs, Downstairs, which was also about a rich family and their servants. And if you look at the difference between Upstairs, Downstairs and Downton Abbey, you can see that there is much more respect for the servants in Downton Abbey. I mean, in the writing, that it's important what happens to them. But I'm not going to talk about Downton Abbey very much, except that it shows, I mean, it's still the past and the present. Yeah, people care about it now. Why do people like Downton Abbey? Is it because they learn about what people's lives were really like? Or is it because we all like to look at the lives of aristocrats, just like we're interested in the life of Rihanna and other stars? Yeah, it's an open question. People debate this. You know, what is the attraction there? Now, much more British and much more striking is the historical reality TV. So what is historical reality TV? Just let me give you an example. You're all here in a university in 2019. I wonder what life was like in a university in 1969, exactly 50 years ago. Let's take a month and reproduce exactly the buildings and the lessons and the attitudes of 1969. And you are not professional actors, just ordinary people, and not even very nice ordinary people for some of you. And so we will get you to live through the experience. This is the reality TV side. There's real history, because it would be really history lessons from the time, and at the end you take the exam from the time and see how you manage. Yeah, and then of course you have all the techniques of reality television. For example, the confession box, where you go off and say, and you talk to a camera, "I can't stand it anymore, they're so cruel," etc. Okay, so people like reality TV, and this is one of the new form. Reality TV has become extremely varied. And this is one of them. So this one is called Back in Time for Dinner. Quite a light-hearted one. What they did is they took a family and they took them back to 1900, but just for the food. And so they said, and the kitchen and so on. And so they said, okay, this week you're all going to eat the food you would have eaten in 1910. And then the next week, 1920. Then the next week, 1930. But it is also serious history. They really did work. There are historians who specialize in the history of food. Yeah, why not? And so this is an example of historical reality TV. Extremely popular, 1 hour every... You can find them all on YouTube if you like that kind of thing. I do. Now, this was called Back in Time for Dinner. And it had, look, series one, episode one. There were two series, or even three, I think. Yeah, I think there were two. There was one 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, and then one went right back to the 19th century. However, there was also a desire, because they talked about traditional English life, which was, if you go back to the 1920s, was very white. And so they thought, well, it'd be nice to use this format to explore the experience of non-white people. And this is, I put an episode of this on the blog, this called Back in Time for Brixton. This is not about food. What they did is they took a black British family from today and they said, okay, let's go back in time and we will explore the experience of a black British family in 1950, in 1960, in 1970. 1 week per decade, yeah? 1 week per decade. And very, very, very serious history. Also very entertaining, of course. Because they come like, wow, have you seen this wallpaper? My God, it's so ugly. You know, it was very wide as well. But obviously also an exploration of the history of racism and anti-racism. The Victorian slum was another example, a very adventurous one, where they got people to pretend they were living in the slum. And, you know, they had people having to make decisions like, you know, she hasn't paid the rent. Are you going to throw her out so she has to sleep in the streets? Now, of course, there are always limits because they can't really make people sleep in the streets. The BBC would get sued. But very ambitious idea, Victorian slum. Now, the slum is very, very bad work, bad housing conditions. And there are many things you can't do in a television series because it's illegal. Yeah, for example, I mean, if you have lead poisoning, well, actually, in Rouen you probably have that now. But if you have lead poisoning everywhere, you can't do that with the television. But attempts to get this through, reality television again, Victorian. Now there are two kinds of historical reality television. There is this time the true reality television, where you just find a family or a group of people, and you make them go back in time. They did a very good one called. I can't even remember what it's called, where they took school children and they made them work like they worked 50 years ago. But there is using ordinary people is classic reality TV, but they also sometimes, that can be quite expensive actually. And so sometimes what they do is they go back in time, but they just use a few historians. Yeah, so you have four historians who go back in time to Victorian times, and they are going to run a pharmacy. Question?
Can you just repeat these
kinds? Yeah, so the two kinds of historical reality TV, do you use just ordinary people, or do you go back in time with historians, which is cheaper? Yeah, it's cheaper because they ordinary people are difficult to organise, yeah, if they've not experienced. So in this case, they will say, oh, okay, well, we have these books from Victorian times. Okay, somebody has a headache. Oh, you have to mix this with this. And then they also talk about the science. Say, actually, this is what the Victorians used, but it didn't work, which was usually the case. Okay, so it is trying to, the attempt is to make history more entertaining. Yeah, to make millions of people want to watch history because it's more entertaining, and it was very, very successful. Edwardian farm, so a farm from the beginning of the 20th century. Servants, the true. Now this is a documentary, actually. Servants, the true story of life below stairs. So these are different. This is not reality television. It's documentary, but it's documentary with reenactment and so on. It's trying to make it more attractive to people. Shop girls, the same thing. The end of the 19th century was the invention of the big shops. I don't know if you have heard of Emile Zola's famous novel about the big shop. What's it called? Au Bonheur des Dames. Au Bonheur des Dames, voilà. Which is an amazing novel, very, very detailed, very informed, about the new huge stores, you know, the Galerie Lafayette, which were completely new. Well, this is that kind of thing. The true story, so documentaries. But sometimes things which are past, but not very far past, can also become history. Here you have, in the British Library, an exhibition about punk rock. British Library, punk rock. It's slightly surprising because punk rock was based on the rejection of the establishment, and the British Library is pretty establishment. So just a last example, and I think that's all we have time for here. We still have more time in the class, but that's all the time I'm going to spend on the le passé pour le présent. Okay, so the idea was to give you some ideas.